Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
Life is full of personal wins, whether it's cleaning your house, getting that dream car, or checking off your to-do list. Winning at life is a great feeling. And with the State Farm Personal Price Plan, you can keep winning when you create an affordable price just for you by bundling home and auto. So give yourself a round of applause. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
Welcome to the ID10T podcast number 948. The future is coming. Make it brighter with Squarespace. Turn your cool idea into a new website. Showcase some of your work. Blog. Publish your content. Sell products and services of all kind. Announce an upcoming event or special project. Don't just rely on social media, which, you know, can be algorithmically challenging when trying to reach your audience nowadays. You don't know if it's going
to
reach the people that are already following you or not. Those companies decide if they're going to let you share the information with the people who've agreed to follow you. But Squarespace absolutely gets you around all that, and they give you beautiful templates created by world-class designers, powerful e-commerce functionality, the ability to customize the look and the feel and the settings of the products more with just a few clicks. Everything is optimized for mobile right out of the box. And if you want to buy domains and choose from over 200 extensions, you can do that as well. Also, analytics that help you grow in real time. SEO, free and secure hosting, nothing to patch or upgrade ever, and 24/7 award-winning customer support. Make it stand out with a beautiful website. Check out squarespace.com/ID10T. You're going to get a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, use the offer code ID10T to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. That is Squarespace. What do you got for the old community corkboard?
Brian Corley writes, I'm a longtime listener who finally got around to making a thing. My self-published book, Ghost Bully, launched a couple months ago, and I think there may be some listeners who may enjoy it. Here's more on the book. Ghost Bully is kind of like what would happen if you mashed up Dark Shadows with Superbad and would be great for fans of David Wong, Lev Grossman, and Jim Butcher. You can find it on Amazon and more. And then Will Leonard writes, my wife is currently training to do her fourth BPMS 150. The last weekend of April, she will be riding her bike from Houston to Austin. That's 150 miles over 2 days to help raise money for the MS Society. What will really put power in her pedals is your support and commitment to those impacted by MS. Every mile we ride brings us closer to a goal, a world free of MS. She would appreciate if you would go to her fundraising site and donate to her cause. It's bit.ly, so it's a bit.ly site, bit.ly/KTMS150. The money raised will help fund amazing progress in MS research, as well as programs and services that ensure people affected by MS can live their best lives. The cause is really important to us, so I hope you will help her end MS forever.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Katie. Also, I'm performing in Madison, Wisconsin at Comedy on State at the end of April. Mike Furman and April Richardson will be there, so hope to see you at that. And this episode is Lorraine Newman, who, of course, is a founding cast member of Saturday Night Live, yeah, and someone that I have gotten to be friends with over the last few years. Lorraine is fucking awesome. She is a comedy lover. She's super cool. Like, literally, you know, she was coming to comedy shows at Meltdown. She came to see when I did like my test shows for Fun Comfortable. She came to that. She would come to beta tests. She is an avid supporter of comedy, and just I just adore her so much, and I was so glad that she came on.
And she's a listener of this podcast.
She listens to the podcast as well. So I'm so happy and honored to be friends with this woman, because she's just cool as shit, Katie. And you know, Lorraine does a ton of voiceover projects as well. You've probably heard her voice in a million things and maybe didn't even realize it. But you can go to her website, wp.lorrainenewman.com, and Lorraine is LARAINE. Lorraine Newman. It's hard not to say her name that way.
It is. It's hard.
I mean, whatever. You know, basically, she's just part of a thing that changed television history. Whatever. You know, it's part of a thing that was one of the most influential things in comedy. Probably the most influential thing in comedy ever.
Yeah.
So thanks to Lorraine for coming on. This episode also brought to you by Buffalo Wild Wings. There's a new boss in town at Buffalo Wild Wings, and he deals in bacon. How do you feel about that voice work?
I think it's perfect.
I feel like that was the way I was supposed to say it.
I think it's perfect for this ad.
Yeah. Do you think it's good, right? Yeah. I feel like it'd be weird to be like, well, there's a new boss in town at Buffalo Wild Wings, and he deals in bacon.
It's like the other one's the winner.
It's better to go on to go on the nose in this case, right? So anyway, the Bacon Boss Burger featuring bacon three different ways and a blanket of white cheese sauce. He's joined by our other new favorites like the smothered cheesesteak quesadilla, sweet chili shrimp, and Alaska Cod Classic. Hurry in today. Try them all before they're gone at Buffalo Wild Wings. Available for a limited time while supplies last. Now in that, I like to pretend that this guy started and this guy wrapped it out. You appreciate it? Is that okay?
I think it's perfect.
Okay, great.
Let's go with it.
You would tell me if it didn't work, right?
Yes.
Okay, you paused for a second there. Mm-hmm.
No.
You didn't pause for a second there? No, you wouldn't tell me.
Yes.
Shit. Just roll the thing.
Initiating ID10T protocol.
Yeah, that's like we had a recessed light and this like kind of black mold looking stuff started coming from it, and then we're like, oh shoot, maybe there's a leak in the roof, and it's just been building in the ceiling. And
so
we were doing
had to open the ceiling.
Well, it's like you know, we called someone to check it out, and they came, and it was like this piece of foam that just shifted for some reason and kind of peeked out of the edge, and we're like.
So it was dirty foam?
It was just foam.
Like, were you worried it was a grudge ghost? Like the ghost of a haunted Korean child?
So. It's just a head of hair. That's all.
It just kept on growing. It becomes a little girl.
But like I asked the guy, I was like, after he's like, oh, it's just this thing, this cover thing got moved somehow. And I was like, okay, cool. But it looked like black mold, right? I wasn't dummy. Sure. So he's like, no, I totally thought it was when I got here.
I started to have symptoms.
Yeah, me and Dee were like, yeah, we have been feeling tired lately.
Oh God!
So maybe the foam is actually toxic, but it's not black mold. It's just a whole different thing to worry about.
Oh, it's filled with asbestos.
Well, I love the word for finding it is remediation.
Yeah,
you know, that just seems like such a weird word for finding mold. It seems like it's a conspiracy.
I'm actually surprised that's not some like DIY network show or something like Mold Hunters.
Yeah.
And they come in and someone's like, oh, there's a little thing, and they open up the wall and it's just like a toxic mold.
Jerry and Amanda had thought their allergies were out of control. Turns out
they're dead.
Kaltiki is under the stucco. Yeah.
I'm so glad you're doing the podcast, Lorraine.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here. I love this podcast.
Oh my
God.
About
time to have you on.
You know, Lorraine, just for people who don't know, Lorraine, besides being an amazing comedy entity, is a fan of comedy and legitimately like goes to tiny little comedy shows just to watch comedy.
I'm inspired. It inspires me.
I love that.
Yeah.
I always worry, though, that the young people think she's a comedy vampire. Beware. Stay away.
Hey, some of us have been disappearing.
Yeah.
What's going on? Turns out for centuries you've just been... Because no vampire ever like was like, I'm going to hit the comedy circuit.
Right, exactly.
You know, it's like they never
it's
like...
It's the perfect cover.
It's perfect.
Is. Cover.
Comics disappear all the time. Yeah, they're at night. Yeah, it's perfect.
Oh, boy, there's just so many bad jokes that just popped into my... brain about some dead comics. Leave it.
I know that is it's funny because with your, you know, like with improv training, you want to spit out whatever comes into your mind, but then just common decency, you can just feel the seams bursting of like the screws popping out of the wall. You're like, I got to keep that in. Yeah. I really got to keep that in.
If I had more balls, I'd, you know, if I had any balls.
Any, yeah.
No, it's I agree with you because I have got not about the balls, but about the keeping it in because I've just. It's just too easy to get burned, especially nowadays. And you're like, fuck, it just wasn't worth it. It was just a throwaway joke. It just wasn't worth it.
Yeah. I guess this is what being an adult is.
Oh, no. In real life, we say terrible jokes to each other all the time.
Yeah.
But it's just on the internet and the privacy. Where someone can track it.
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing. Like, if a non-comedy person heard comics in a room, they would go, you're the worst human being. You'd go, no, we're saying this because we know it's... We don't believe these things. No. Just comics. This is how we shock each other, and this is how we communicate. It's not real.
Yeah, it's a manifestation of our fear.
Of course it is. And we all have a lot of that.
And that's will be a $1.98.
Quite a reasonable. That's a reasonable therapy session.
It is.
$1.98.
$198.
Oh, okay, that's a little. Even that's like, oh wow, that's a good deal. That's all right, they could get up to like $300, $350 an hour. But I would love to talk. Oh, first of all, I also owe you a huge debt of thanks for. I'm telling Jonah this, you know, because you were there, but. Lorraine, the TV Hall of Fame, the TV Academy Hall of Fame, I got to induct Joan Rivers, obviously posthumously, and then Lorraine, like the first season cast of SNL, was there. And Bill Murray showed up, and Bill was a second season guy, but he came with Aykroyd.
I had no idea that he was not included in the thing. I texted him and said, are you going to this thing? This is what we always do when there's events. We always check with each other, you know, are you going? Are you going? And so I texted Billy, and he said, I don't know what you're talking about. And I legitimately thought, well, they just don't have his address. They just don't know how to contact him. So I told him all the details, and he came, and he was not included in the clips, nothing. You know, and I realized then, in that moment, that they just thought that because he was not in the first season, he wasn't considered the original cast member, which is crazy. Huh. And I was so embarrassed. I just felt so bad. It haunted me. And, you know, I was driving him to the airport, and he was on the phone with his brother Joel. And because we were talking about some air-efficient car or something like that. And so Joel says, so how was the thing? And he says, well, I wasn't in the eclipse or anything. And I thought, oh, my God, he's hurt.
Oh, wow. Oh,
no. He's hurt. And I felt like such a schmuck. I just should have left alone.
Well, wow. I love that. I mean, listen, I love that, and not to glom onto your pain in that situation, but I love that even you can have those moments where you go, oh, why did I?
God.
Because Lorraine noticed that I was sort of hovering around Bill, and Dan knows Lydia's mom, and so he was very like approachable and very, you know. Bill's just one of those guys where you just don't know. I mean, like, I've heard sometimes where he's amazing to talk to and other times where the walls are up and he just doesn't want to talk. So I just didn't – there are very few people where I feel like I don't know what I would say, and he's just one of those guys. And Lorraine noticed that I was kind of sitting there. She goes, you want to meet Bill? And I'm like – and so she kind of – she opened it up and she was like, Bill, this is Chris. You know, he's – started this thing called Nerdist, and I mean, I don't even remember what I said.
I said he started an empire, and this is someone I think you'd really enjoy knowing.
Nice.
Oh, and I just didn't have a response. I was like, I'm just a comic. I don't know anything.
Yeah.
And then we have this picture where I'm so clearly tense because I'm so afraid of ever bothering anyone.
Yeah, because everybody thinks exactly the way you do, Chris.
Of course.
Yeah. Everybody sees you the way you see yourself.
That's all I need. I need to believe
that'll be another $1.98.
Yeah, that's man, well, that's almost $4 already. What are we, $3.96 at this point? But in those situations, it just is. It's very tricky because you just, you know, and it's nice that you all have each other as a group, as sort of a you can flank and protect each other. Mm-hmm. And
well, I've learned throughout the years of meeting my idols that it's never satisfying because you have a fantasy of what you want it to be, and it'll never be that. They're a stranger. You know, you've got to remember they're a stranger.
And you know them and they don't know you.
Exactly.
Yeah. Usually.
Usually, yeah.
It's nice when you, if you do meet someone and there's a hint of recognition, even if they don't quite, you're like, okay, at least there's a little something. But if there's nothing, then you're just like.
Yeah. Mortifying.
Hi, nice to meet you.
Why did I do that?
But it's great that you guys all still and the presentation was really incredible.
I was impressed with Garrett. I thought he was hilarious.
He was really, really funny.
And 80 years old. I had no idea he was that old.
Oh, I didn't know he was 80 years old.
He was the oldest out of all of you, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
He still looks great.
Doesn't he?
He still performs. Well, he did for a long time because he had that club downtown for a while.
Yeah, and he's got one, I think, like it's mid-Wilshire or on Sunset or something like that, that he's trying to get going, and he wants to introduce new comics. I think he's pitching it as a show, too.
Oh, wow. Cool.
You know, like jazz and comedy.
Yeah, yeah.
Love the comedy part. Hate the jazz.
We need a location. Skip it a bob it. All right.
You got to pay.
I always love Matt Dwyer's joke about like scatting jazz guys. He's like, how did that guy end up? It's like a bunch of guys hanging out. I was like, well, you know, I play bass. I'll play the bass. Yeah, Chris, you play drums. Rain, you're a trumpet player. What about you, Katie? Well, I can talk like a stroke victim.
That's great.
That's Matt Dwyer.
Yeah.
That's a great joke.
I was always like improvised jazz. It was like, we're never going to play. We're never going to play anything that you can recognize or enjoy. We're never, never going to play.
Try to find the hook. You can't. Yeah. It's like, well, Howard Kramer's joke about jazz is like, he can't stand it. Like improv jazz because it just sounds like running errands. Like, then I got to go to the cleaners. I got to score.
The street's closed.
Yep. I mean, I would love to, if you don't mind, just sort of talk about the founding of the Groundlings and the early days of the Groundlings. And because I just, Alan Alda was just on a couple days ago. We were talking about like the sort of formation of modern improv comedy, which I think he was in probably the early, one of the earliest generations of how improv kind of is now.
Like proto-Second City.
Was he in
with
Compass
Alan Alda.
Theater?
Right?
Yes. Yeah,
he was in Compass.
It was either Compass or an offshoot of Compass, but he was in that sort of original, like one of the original groups in the early 60s.
Right.
And so in the 70s, there's this massive boom that starts to happen where people are not just participating in comedy, but going out to see live comedy, and you have, you know, like a wave of super comics, Pryor and Carlin and Robin and all these huge, huge comedians explode. And then, you know, people go out to see live shows. So what was sort of the inception of that, and how did it happen?
Well, my experience was I was at CalArts for like 3 minutes. And I met Paul Rubens there. He was like an architecture student or something like that. And his hair was as long as mine. I mean, try and imagine that. And I just didn't like CalArts. It wasn't for me. But my sister was in this improv workshop that was run by this guy, Gary Austin, who had been involved with the committee, but I don't really know how. But I went to the workshop, and the people in it were like Jack Su, Pat Morita, Tim Matheson, Valerie Curtin, who was actually Jane's cousin, but was writing partners with Barry Levinson, and a bunch of other people that went on to be showrunners for, you know, shows in the 80s and 90s.
Was Jack Su the guy? Was he on Barney Miller?
Yes.
Yeah, that guy, right.
Yeah.
And this is all at CalArts?
This is at the Groundlings.
Oh, this is when you...
When it was just a workshop, just people to goof around and you know, come up with stuff. And we started doing shows. We were at the Oxford Theater, in a neighborhood that I just love Blaine Kapatch's quote about, this looks like a good place to give up. that was the neighborhood that our theater was in. And we just started doing shows. And then after that, we came up with a name. You know, everybody wanted to be the Groundlings. I thought that was a dopey name that we would outgrow. So I voted for the Working Class, which I thought was very clever.
Very clever.
Very clever.
Very clever.
And then we started doing shows from there. It was just, that's how it happened.
And was the focus on games or long form or comedy or not comedy? Was it more acty, or was the focus initially comedy?
It was really comedy. It was the basic improv games, you know, presenting stuff that you may have come up with. And then we would have scene night where you would present your new stuff. And but then sketches would also come out of improv, which is very common. That's usually how it works. And then, you know, Gary, who was our director, and what a great director. I mean, so affirming and encouraging and nurturing. He would create the show sketch, you know, the Order. And that was it. And we were in a theater. This was like a 99-seat theater. And usually there were more people on stage than in the audience. But it was also, the audience was also composed of a lot of people that were part of that new comedy wave. The Comedy Store just opened up. I was too young to get in. I wasn't 21 yet, so I would watch stuff through the curtain. And I would see people like Freddie Prinz and Richard Pryor, the Step Brothers, which I think was Rudy DeLuca, Barry Levinson, and Craig T. Nelson.
Holy shit.
And just all sorts of stuff that was new. It was just, you know, but you would see people trying out new material. Like I saw Richard Pryor try out this bit about when you break up with someone and you see them again and you want to somehow get them engaged with you. So you say something like, you left some hangers at the place. Do you want them? You know, and I thought that was so great, which you never used. I mean, you know, it was so thrilling to see all of that kind of stuff. And there were all sorts of great drag clubs, if you can believe that, on Beverly Boulevard. Hmm. And it never occurred to me to see that kind of stuff, that content, but it was all there and it was fabulous. Wailing Flowers and Madam started at that time. And I'm trying to think, it was just at that time, it was the Comedy Store.
Yeah.
That was it.
And they were letting people go and do sketch there too. That's why you guys were...
We weren't doing sketch at the Comedy Store.
You were just
no, but at one point they wanted to cast the new Smothers Brothers show, so they had a lot of us audition on the stage in the the original room, that really small one.
Yeah.
And I remember them saying, "And now Valerie Bromfield," and I'm thinking, another Jewish comedian, not you know, and Dan Aykroyd's partner from Canada, and a genius. An absolute genius with characters. And she was on our first show, actually. We had, you know, new talent. And Billy Crystal was supposed to do it. But they wanted him to make internal cuts. And his bit, you couldn't do that. You know, one bit depended on the next and the next and the next. So he said, "I'm not doing it," which I felt, you know, I can only imagine what it was for him. But at the time, it was the first show we ever did, so who would have known how well the show would have done? But she took his place. So she's in the first episode.
Wow.
And she's great.
Of SNL?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I mean, those early SNL shows are so fascinating because my parents noticed that I was transfixed by SNL when it started. 75?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I was like 4. And my parents just noticed that I was transfixed by it. And again, they didn't go, "Oh, this isn't really appropriate," or they didn't. But you know what's interesting about that show is that it, not every sketch like murdered the audience. However, there was something so different and raw and unique, you know, especially coming out of the 60s where everything's all rosy and it's, you know, listen, Smothers Brothers was a great show, but it's certainly edgy in its own way and laughing, but it was all sort of like, and this was very much in that this is gritty and real and this is shit that people really talk about. And, you know, I just remember some sketch of Bill Murray going, I think it was like an STD sketch, but he goes, "My penis hurts when I urinate." And I can't remember what the rest of the sketch was, but I just remember, I think it was Bill saying that.
I know Al Franken wrote it, but I don't remember who said it. I'm so impressed by the fact that you were interested in it at the age of 4.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, I have kids. I know what they're like at 4, and that's just amazing to me.
Yeah, well, when Steve Martin started coming on and Steve started blowing up, you know, I was transfixed by him. Mm-hmm. And so my parents just started buying me the albums. But it all really came from SNL.
Wow.
And so was, you know, that process of... Because you were, a lot of the people were Second City, right? Or they came down from Second City? Or how did you kind of float into that group?
Well, I had worked with Lauren once before on a Lily Tomlin special. She and Lauren came to see the show at the Oxford Theater. I didn't know they were in the audience, and they cast me in her special. They had seen The Valley Girl. And Lily had this character named Susie Sorority. And so they cast my character in that. I had like one line and it played so well in the read through. They gave me a bigger part, which was so thrilling.
Wow.
And a lot of Groundlings are all through that special.
You came to the last At Midnight taping.
Yes. Oh, it was so exciting.
And it was really great to have you there. And then a couple of days later, I get this package in the mail. I'm like, what's this? And it's the original Killer Bees sketch that you sent me. And you go, I thought you might like to have this. And I'm like, what? This I felt like Indiana Jones, like, it belongs in a museum. Because it's so pristine. It's so well preserved. The only way that you can tell that it's not new is that it's written on a typewriter.
Yeah.
So it's either like old or a hipster wrote it. But it's just the notes, like the little notes in it.
Well, there's also rust where the staple was on the paper.
Did you think why'd you hold on to it and keep it in good shape?
I don't know.
Because sometimes it's like when I have stuff, I go, this means something to me, but it's just clutter. It's just stuff.
Oh,
who cares about this?
And God, there's a lot of stuff I've thrown out that I wish I hadn't. Because I am a compulsive cleaner and divester, to my regret. But I kept a lot of sketches. I kept Coneheads and Landshark and
Landshark.
Basilatic.
At least once an episode of Mystery Science Theater, I write a Landshark joke.
Really?
Yeah. Just anytime there's a knock on the door, I just go, Landshark.
Oh my God.
It's one of those, with a lot of sketches, you can sort of do the math and go, okay, I see where they started. I see where maybe they wrote this one backward and ended with a joke. Landshark is just one of those ones where it was like, someone just was tickled by an idea and it's just uniquely them. Was it Chevy? Whose was that?
I don't know who wrote that. I don't have any idea. I wish I could tell you. I think, I love what you're getting at, which is the idea that our sketches were very personal. And it was the kind of stuff that we would think about, but it's like, other people like it? Oh, that's great, because we really also thought we were working in a vacuum. We had no idea if anybody was watching us. We were like the redheaded stepchild, NBC. They gave us like all the furniture, their shit furniture from like the early 70s, that horrible barf palette, It was brown and beige and, I guess nobody had any idea.
I went to SNL at the end of last year and I was chatting with Lauren about it and I said, oh, Lorraine sent me the original Killer Bee sketch. And he just kind of nodded and he goes, yeah, I came in over Christmas to write that one. I remember that. Like, he just remembered.
Oh, wow.
He remembered even writing it.
Oh,
and
my
it
God.
Just, for me, going to SNL, and I said this to him, I was like, it's like a living museum. It's a living, breathing museum to even be in here. Because you walk down the hall and it's just all the group shots over the years. And you think about, there just isn't... I mean, the closest thing maybe might be like The Simpsons or something that's just where you can tell like has been so influential to comedy. And so, even this far in, to still be making social commentary and to still be on and to still be, And again, it's not like every sketch knocks it out of the park. But the ones that do are amazing. And also, you're writing a fucking 90-minute show in like 4 days, fucking days. It's mind-blowing to me.
Yeah, and the third of the month, because I don't think we did four a month. We did three. And that show was either abysmal or brilliant because everybody was so tired.
Yeah.
You either produce the greatest stuff or the worst. And one could never tell which it would be, So I don't know. I imagine if you were to look at a pattern and really look at them, you would see that pattern. There's a sketch that we did that, the ensemble sketches to me are the ones that really make me laugh still. And I uncovered this one with Steve Martin. It was called Beatniks. And it's such a good representation of Michael O'Donohue's writing style, Tom Schiller. I think a bunch of other people might have written on it, but it's one of my favorite sketches that we ever did. And it's long. It's like 12 minutes. But everybody is so great in it, and it is so deep. The comedy in it is so deep. I think Steve is, first of all, Steve with one of those little billy goat thing, beards and a beret. Belushi comes out as like the sick comic. It was supposed to be Lenny Bruce, clearly. And he really plays this guy who is strung out, and only the band is laughing at his jokes, which kills me. And, you know, I think I was an angry Jewess named Isidore Schwartz who comes out and does modern dance. I mean, just, it's so tasty. You guys should watch it.
Yeah, that's, is it available on the app?
Yeah.
Might be, yeah.
On the app?
The app had, there's an SNL app that has, like, almost any sketch you could ever want.
Well, I had no idea.
Yes.
I thought
we were talking about the discs. An application is a little place where things live.
In the little box that is a phone.
Yes.
Yes.
A little rectangular box.
But it's, the most obscure sketches you can think of, almost all of them are in there, and you just type it up and it comes up. Or if you just say, oh, I want to see, like, Joe Piscopo, it just brings up all the Piscopo sketches or whatever.
Great.
Yeah, they did it is a public service to people who are fans of comedy or SNL.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah, I might have to pull it up before you leave just to see, like, we can just test it to see if it...
Look for the superheroes party.
Well, I remember the superheroes
isn't
party.
Isn't that a great one?
Yeah, that's,
I love
that's
that.
The one where Belushi comes out as a Hulk and is like, yeah, nobody... they, like, took a shit in the... Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Oh,
I love that.
That one's fantastic. I mean, So you didn't really understand what it was in the beginning. It was just like, oh, we have this opportunity and we're just going to do what we do and who knows?
Yeah,
it's just one of those things.
First of all, it was going to be 13 weeks. And I think we all really believed that because at least, even though we were all beginners, we knew not to expect it to be lasting. You know, it was like, you know, when Lorne presented it to me at the Chateau. He said it's 13 weeks with a 5-year option. And I'm thinking, like, that'll ever happen. And there we were. And I think it was like the second year, Gilda and I were walking, I think, on Fifth Avenue or something, and people were yelling out our lines from the night before.
Wow.
And that's when we realized that people were actually watching us. That was exciting.
Huh. That's insane because, you know, when you think about where y'all came from, just Groundlings or improv theater, they're typically just very small, very intimate, and you usually just like, oh, this is just a special thing that's just for us, like us and 100 people.
Yeah, like the cool people that showed up for the show,
right.
The new.
But then to think that all of a sudden in public people are like, you know, shouting, you know, I am from France or whatever it is.
Yeah.
That... oh, wow, this is way bigger than we are. I mean, is that
does
that affect the type of comedy you're writing? Or do you have to fight the urge to, like, oh, my God, we need to write popular sketches now?
Well, I think it was a practical business decision on Lorne's part to repeat characters that were popular, you know, and I think that made sense. But in terms of the actual content, he was very clear that the audience comes to us. We don't go to them. Mm. And I think he's always maintained that, except for the Trump stuff that keeps going on and on and on.
And on.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I think in the first 5 years, for sure, we did not serve the audience. We presented what we thought was funny, and hopefully they got it and liked it. And that was really the most gratifying aspect of it, because up until then, all of that material was so, as I said, personal to us. And we never saw anything that looked like us on TV before. When Lorne had cast me in the show, I was still in Los Angeles. He says, I want you to go meet Dick Ebersol. He's the producer. And I thought, well, I'm finished. Because, you know, I've never seen anybody that looked like me on TV. But he turned out to be such a great guy. I went to see him at the Beverly Hills Hotel, and I talked to him through a screen door because he had pneumonia.
Oh, no.
You know? And he said, yeah, I come from the wide, wide world of sports, so that completely qualifies me for comedy. I mean, he was so endearing, you know?
Did repeating the sketches at a certain point, was there a rejection to that of, like, I don't want to do this again, I want to do something new, or was it just sort of part of the...
Well, that was my mindset to my... everlasting regret, but I don't know that other people felt that way. I can't say.
Where did Coneheads come from?
Well, Lorne in the beginning had us do improv at his loft in an effort to make the cast, you know, gel, which was a good idea, but it never really caught on. But one improv, we did several improvs, and one was an alien family. So Danny was the dad, Jane was the mom, and I was the kid. And I came up with a voice like this. And then Tom Davis and Danny went to Easter Island, and they saw the...
The big heads.
The big heads, and that is really how it all came about. That's how it happened. I love knowing that, too.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
I mean, that sketch lived on. When did Conan's movie was like 91, 92?
I don't know.
I think it was 95.
Was it really?
Something like that, yeah. Because there was a Red Hot Chili Peppers song on the soundtrack, yeah. And that was from this album after.
Well, I know what a huge Red Hot Chili Peppers fan you are.
I'm a big pep head.
Yep. Is that what they're called? Pepperheads.
That's the guys who like that other reggae band.
Oh, that's like Trekker versus Trekkie. Yeah. I understand. Yeah, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to.
What is the distinction between Trekker and Trekkie?
I don't know.
I don't think there really is one anymore, but in the early days of fandom, I think most Star Trek fans would identify as Trekkies.
Okay.
I don't know, Trekker doesn't sound right to me. Right. And I don't think most people would go along with it.
Yeah.
But I've read that your time that you kind of didn't love being in New York at that time.
Well, I was very young and very inexperienced, and I was in a very kind of familial situation at the Groundlings. My sister was there. My older brother ran lights. And I had my place, you know. When Lorne presented this idea to me and said, "And you don't mind living in New York, do you?" And I'm thinking, fuck! You know, I don't want to move to New York. My God, away from my Groundlings family, away from my family. I didn't know anybody except Lorne. So it was difficult for me. And also, when you come from a car culture, I know how minuscule this sounds, but you feel so imprisoned when you can't drive yourself around. You know, God forbid you want to do, like, a grocery shopping and pick up your dry cleaning in one day. It's complete toil. And I know that sounds really mundane, but it was one of the things that was really kind of depressing to me.
But it gives you a chip on the shoulder, which is nice.
Yeah, which
helps
good.
You push your way through people
yes.
on the subway.
Yeah. I mean, I just had such a West Coast mentality, which was so open and candid. And my impression of the East when I was living there was that you can't be like that, you know?
Because I imagine it's just because everyone, just to survive that city, they walk out of their building and they just, like, the bubble goes up. Because you just can't engage with that many people at once. I think it's just a protective measure of, like, I just need to get where I'm going and push through and not have to deal with
it. We don't need bubbles. We have cars out here.
Right. Those are our bubbles.
Who did you, like, so you're going out there, you're real young. Who did you kind of get a couple friends, like, on the show, or were they outside the show?
Gilda was my first friend.
Yeah.
And she took me over to, she was in the middle of doing that Lampoon album, That's Not Funny, That's Sick.
Yeah.
And so that's when I first met Harold Ramis and Bill Murray and Brian Doyle Murray and Bob Tischler. And they said, hey, why don't you come and record with us? So I did. Oh, Chris Guest, too. And so those were, like, some of the first people I met. And then when I met Tom Schiller, he looked familiar to me, and we had gone to the same grammar school.
No way.
I recognized him from that. My sister had been his camp counselor. You know, it's all connected.
Small world.
It's very connected.
That National Lampoon crowd, kind of, did that feel a little similar to the Groundlings crew? No.
It was so unto itself. Oh, I really didn't know anything about the Lampoon. I had never read it. When Lorne presented the show to me, he says, it'll be a cross between 60 Minutes and Monty Python. And I what is Monty Python? I'm just thinking that, you know, and nodding my head enthusiastically. Yeah.
Well, sure, at the time, like, things were not as accessible.
Right.
Yeah.
You couldn't just, you know, if someone was like Monty Python, like, even now, I'm looking up the SNL app. Oh, in seconds, I'm going to have this app. I'm going to find that thing. But if someone said Monty Python to you then and you were in America, oh, that's interesting. What is that a thing? What is that? You know, like, someone would have to, You couldn't even give someone a tape. I don't even know. I don't know what you would do.
Yeah, I don't know what my route to finding them would have been.
Right.
I know that if I'd found them, I would have loved them. But I just, it never came into my atmosphere. Hmm.
I would be willing to bet that those in the 70s, it must have been like 40 million people a night watching SNL. I mean, like, I would imagine the number is staggering. Because there's only three channels at the time. And, you know, on Saturday nights, like, at that hour, if people aren't out, you know, what else is there to, you know? So I would imagine, do you know what the numbers were in those days?
God, no. No. You see, Chris, I was thinking about me most of the time. No, I have no idea what the numbers were. I mean, you know, at the Monday meeting when we were pitched to the host, we would get the numbers. And they just kept getting better and better and better, you know. Hmm. And, of course, you know, with the share now with so much content, it's nothing compared to the share you would get when there's only three channels.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, like, if you get a few million people watching something, they're like, great.
It's a hit.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just not the same thing at all. Shows, like, some of the top-rated shows today would have been canceled.
Yeah.
A couple decades ago. Like, yeah. No one's watching that. No one's going to watch that. But was the culture at that time... I mean, I think when I think about it, I go, it must have been crazy and people running around doing drugs and it was nuts and it was chaotic. Did it feel that way? Is that not a correct perception of what was going on?
That's somewhat accurate. You know, I think that just the first blush of that kind of success, none of us really were prepared for that. And all of the things that come with it, you know, the publicity, the attention, the doors that open, the free stuff, you know. So I think that for all of us in some way, because we all do have a hole in us, a God-shaped hole. No.
That's what we're really here to talk about.
I can't imagine that any of us weren't feeling like, gimme, gimme, gimme. You know, this was great. It was exciting. Yeah. Exciting as fuck.
Particularly in a decade of excess like the 70s, where it's just like disco and drugs and people fucking, you know, just like all of those things that you think about. I mean, I lived through the 70s, but I was a child.
Right.
I don't really know. I can't really say that I know exactly what they were like. Mm-hmm. But God, New York in the 70s at that time must have been fucking bananas.
Well, you know, there's one misconception about the drug situation, which is that somehow, you know, they couldn't take their success, so they got hooked on drugs, you know. Nobody's going to do that if they're not already predisposed to it.
Sure.
You know, I know I came there with a problem already. You know? And I think that John did too, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, some of us were just luckier than others. But I remember when the Rolling Stones were our hosts, they had some guy who had pharmaceutical coke. And
how is that different from
that's Keith Richards is like, that's what he says is like how he's survived all
these years. Oh, because he knows, like, he takes it like a prescription drug, like, yeah. He knows exactly how much.
He's like, I know where it comes from.
It's different. It's really different, you know. I'm just trying to remember the experience of that cocaine versus the street cocaine.
This is delightful cocaine.
It's delicious.
There's a story in Steve Martin's book where he showed up to host, and he got there and started talking to Lauren, and then Dan Aykroyd came in and he was like bested up, like wet, and like what happened? He's all, I rode my bike out to Jersey. It broke down. I tried to thumb a ride back in. I got into a car, and then as we got up to speed, a guy kicked me out on the turnpike.
Oh, God.
Did you ever hear of that happening?
I didn't hear that story, but Danny's certainly a citizen of the world.
Was he, like, really wild? Because it's like, when I read that in Steve Martin's book, I was just like, I never would have thought. I thought he, like, liked cool stuff, but I didn't know that he was, like, a rambunctious dude like that.
He was... kind of fearless. You know, some of the greatest performers I've ever seen, like Phil Hartman and Danny, Keegan-Michael Key, mm-hmm. These are some of the best improvisers I've ever seen in my life. And one thing that they all seem to have in common is that they are fearless. And Danny is just, you know, he takes a big bite out of life. And he does it for no other reason, not for his image. He's not self-conscious about it. It's just his real essence as someone who is an adventurer, you know?
Yeah.
But was there, as the show started getting successful, I would imagine there are those things that happen where it's like, oh, that person's getting more sketches than me, or that, oh, that character, but my character didn't. Oh, I mm-hmm. got cut, but other... Oh, well, I'm going to go do my own thing. Fuck all of you. I mean, did that start percolating? Did it, you know, and if so, how did you navigate it?
Well, it happened for everybody at one point or another. I mean, it still happens, I'm sure. It's just that people, the good thing about the cast now and over the years is they're a little more mature. You know, they've come there, they've had more experience, they understand the lay of the land. None of us did. I mean, Gilda was really clever in that she collaborated with Alan Zweibel, who is a superb writer. But I certainly couldn't see the big picture. So I collaborated with some people. But it was obvious. I mean, like, John had a tough time with Chevy's success and so on. And so, you know, everybody dealt with it their own way. I heard Zweibel told me that Conan O'Brien said about writing on the show that it was like getting beaten up on the schoolyard every day. You know, it's tough. It's a difficult atmosphere. And I know it was only after, I hate to say this, but it was only after that show that I knew that there was such a thing as a happy set. Because it wasn't, you know, at that time, it wasn't a happy set.
Well, it just, I mean, you know, everything about it was so new, you know, it's like the Groundlings is relatively new at that point, and then all of a sudden this format is new, and the 70s were new, and stuff that there's so much that it's almost unfair because you weren't prepared to process it all. And it was also not like now where people are like, maybe you should get into therapy, or let's try to talk about it, or let's. It was just like fucking drink it, you know.
Yeah,
you know,
jump.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's for a variety of reasons. Sometimes I look back at that era and I go, it's a wonder anyone survived. Yeah. You know, any of that stuff is crazy to me.
Yeah, I don't think you can ever predict what's going to happen, and. It was, I guess, a social phenomenon at the time. And then over the years, the show matured just as any other entity would, you know. So I think it was different.
Did I hear this correctly that when, because, you know, everyone kind of spoke when they were getting the induction into the Hall of Fame, except for Bill. But it's also kind of comforting to know, like, hey, a guy like that who...
Yeah,
is literally one of the most successful comedy forces who is given some of the most iconic performances that could never be replicated by anyone and is in multiple of my favorite movies of all time, could still go, oh man, I wasn't any other... Yeah. It's like, yeah, but didn't things worked out for you though,
don't
right?
People have multiple tattoos of your face on their bodies. Isn't that also true?
Yeah. So it is kind of comforting to hear
it
that as
is.
Well.
It is.
He just wanted to go feel good about himself. Went to Austin and bartended with, like, you know, Wu-Tang Clan or something like that.
That's some the kind of thing that I feel like Bill Murray just like he's just appears sometimes. Yeah. He might appear at your bar mitzvah. He might appear, you know, at a wedding. He might DJ at something. You just never know.
Yeah, I mean, he takes a bite out of life in his own way, you know, not really caring about how he's perceived. He's curious. And that's what I think is so compelling about him.
But what I noticed with him is because when he was watching the sketches and he was watching all of you accept the award, he was smiling and he was genuinely laughing at the sketches. And it occurred to me that he's just a guy who's been doing this for so long that he's sort of conditioned that if he's not interested in something, he doesn't really have to pretend to be interested. But when he's interested, he's interested.
Yeah.
So if he's in a situation and he doesn't really feel like being there, he just doesn't be there.
Yeah.
And if he's excited, then he'll be excited. Mm-hmm. And so it kind of gave me a real a different understanding of a guy I don't really know.
Well, it's good to see people's humanity.
Yeah.
You know, and the perspective of someone who, in our minds, and actually truthfully, is unimaginably successful and idiosyncratic at the same time. He does what he does, and it's not guided by any, you know, popular vision of what has to be or should be. It's him, you know, and he has been able to use his personality to his best, you know, result. And what could be better than that?
Yeah, but I can imagine it's weird, though, when all day, every day, people are like, oh, my God, you're a genius. Oh, my God, you're the best. Oh, my God, you're the... I mean, you... I think someone might go, what's wrong with that? Like, well, because there is a disconnect from reality, because you as a person don't walk... Most people don't walk the earth and go, what a genius I am. All day. Like, at a certain point, that would... You might be like, oh, that's great. I just... You know, you would probably build up a little bit of armor, you know? Because it's kind of a strange... I think as humans, as much as we strive for things, it can be a little... odd when the spotlight is on you when you're not on stage, you know, got to feel a little strange. You're not in control of it.
It's a rare experience, I'm sure.
But seeing Chevy at the thing kind of, if I'm not mistaken, did he say like it was a big mistake that I left after the first season?
I don't remember him saying that, but I trust you.
I thought he alluded to, and maybe it was something kind of under his breath, but I just remember I was watching it backstage on a monitor and just going, oh, that's really interesting. It felt to me like he was saying, like, you know, I left this thing, and that was probably a mistake at the time, but I was, you know, going through some stuff.
I think that Chevy's, you know, at a stage in his life where he's willing to expose that vulnerability, you know, and admit that there are things in his life that he regrets, especially since he's been, you know, renowned as kind of an asshole.
Right.
And I think that he absolutely regrets that and is hurt by the things that people say, absolutely devastated by it. Hmm. That's my impression.
Right.
You know?
To be honest, that was a terrible impression of Chevy Chase.
I'm sorry.
Oh, my God. Are you mad? But when you look back at those early sketches, too, there's so many of them, even with the Killer Bee sketch, where you go, oh, you couldn't do that today. Oh, you probably wouldn't get away with that.
Yeah.
Oh, you wouldn't be able to get away with that. That the show, even though it was edgy for the 70s, what is like, I think a lot of those early sketches are just way off limits today. Immediately people are like, how could you say that?
Yeah.
Oh, you're marginal? How could you? Well, that's not funny, you know. Yeah. But at the time, it was just, there was a different, that's why I always say, like, it's very dangerous to go back and look at older comedy with present eyes.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, well, there were different conversations going on at the time. And right or wrong, it's just, this is what came out of the culture at that time.
Yeah.
But it is a stuff. But even just reading the Killer Bee sketch, I'm like, I don't know if they...
I think I gave you Uncle Roy, too.
You did,
really wrong. You know? And now that I have kids, it's like, Jesus Christ.
What was it like? So, like, you put in the 5 years. At what point did you start to get kind of tired of it and worn out? And, like, did you get miserable? And were you looking forward to that 5-year contract being up?
I was looking forward to going home. And it was clear that Lorne wasn't going to stay, so we didn't want to stay. I was very homesick. The whole time I was there, I was homesick. So I was very much looking forward to going home. But I wouldn't say that I was sick of the work. Sketch, as I said, you know, at that induction, it is the most fun work I've ever done. I love it, you know. There are shows on like now, like Another Period and Drunk History. Those shows, to me, are so funny and look like so much fun to do.
Yeah.
I mean, I would be surprised. Did you ever do Another Period?
No, and I'm dying to. I talked to Ricky at some event, and... I can't believe what I said, too, because I am not the kind of person that would say, I could really nail that, you know? But I think I said something like that to her, and I'm so mortified that I did that. Yeah.
Oh, again.
I'm sure she was stoked.
But I want to do that show so badly.
Yeah. Again, I'm so delighted that you had a moment where you said something because you got excited, and then immediately was like, stupid. Why can't I keep my mouth shut?
God, there's some movie where that... Oh, what is it? Is it Star 80? Oh, never mind. Just ignore me. I'm sorry.
We're not going to ignore you. You're the guest.
Yeah. Okay.
We are going to fully focus on you.
All right.
What, when you,
at your peril.
When you came back to L.A. After SNL, did you have a plan, or were you expecting like things to start kind of coming your way? What was your life like just shortly after you left?
Well, I grew up in Los Angeles. I grew up part of the time in Beverly Hills. So, you know, we were across the street from Edgar Bergen, down the street from Kirk Douglas, around the corner from Groucho Marx. And I, as a teenager, would see actors that had been on a series and then were no longer on a series. And that was a look on their face that was one I never wanted to have on mine. And I intuited, I had no plan to be a performer or anything, but I intuited that it was a miserable state. It can be, it doesn't have to be, but for a lot of the people I saw, it seemed to be. And so I was prepared for that possibility. And it was a good thing that I was. I mean, you know, I was at ICM and they packaged me in a lot of stuff. But it wasn't really until I started to do animation that I had a real possession of myself and of my work and what I really felt I was good at. Because I didn't, you know, I was introduced to my limitations. How do you do? My, you're big. And, you know, I realized that it was tough for me to do other people's material. I didn't know how. I think part of it was just the years and years of being high since age 14. I didn't have reference. You know, I so anesthetized myself from the experiences of life that fundamental things that are written, I didn't know them. I didn't understand them or how to do them. So, and that's very distracting when you try and work and you know that it's not quite right, you know, that you're not nailing it. But once I found animation, I was really home. That's what I just love doing so much. And it took me a long time to break in. Katie!
God damn it!
God!
We were having a moment. She was opening up.
Oh, my God. I can't go back.
Get new hands.
It's
our producer.
I know. God.
Not anymore.
She produces noise.
You're fired. Yeah.
Oh, my God. I could never fire Katie.
Oh, I know.
This podcast, I feel like this podcast could survive without me more than it could survive without her. Yeah.
It's that cute, sweet young voice in the background. Katie, is that right? Yes, it is. Could you look that up? Yeah, I just did.
No one's done a Katie before. That's great. Oh, that's the best.
I love the sound of your voice so much. It is so sweet and youthful, you know, which you are, but I mean, sometimes people don't have that tone.
Katie,
watch out for the vampire.
Yeah. I'm here.
Your youth.
Look out.
Is that a vein I see?
Is that a vocal cord I see? So, yeah, it took me 2 solid years of auditioning for animation. And then I got a series, and I never stopped working.
Wow.
And it's a very rarefied world. You know, you have to have really a specific set of talents.
But sketch is so great for that world because you have to, especially when you're auditioning or even if they just throw characters at you in the moment, like, oh, just do this one too. You have to build a character like that
with
almost no information, maybe a reference
maybe
picture.
Maybe a drawing. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, maybe a drawing.
Well, and you then and I both know Andrea.
Romano, the best.
She gave me my first job.
What was it?
Which was Pinky and the Brain.
Oh.
Did not know Rob Paulsen or Maurice LaMarche. And in that session, my stomach was gurgling a lot. I was so mortified. And then they embarked on this thing, not knowing that I'm one of the 9 women in the world that thinks farts are funny, making these fart noises. And I don't know how I got through that session. I was laughing so hard. And, you know, the sound effects that Rob was making that was clearly water and matter landing into the water. It was unbelievable. I was dying. And
voiceover
they always tease me about it. Yeah, they're
voiceover
great.
People really are the best. It's such a great community. And there's also no there's just no boundaries in the sense that, you know, a good voiceover group will come in, know how to fuck around, but then focus when they need to focus and then continue fucking around, but our friend Andrea Romano retired.
Yeah.
And so she had she was on the podcast a few years ago, and it was one of those ones where people listen and they would say, they talked to me about it for months, and they would say, I didn't know who she was, but when she started talking and I saw what she was involved with, and it ended up inspiring me. Like, Andrea is just like a halo of warmth.
Yeah.
And really was responsible for so much of what made people's childhood great, like all of the Warner Brothers animation.
Wow.
You know, the original Batman animated series, Tiny Toons, Animaniacs, Pinky and the Brain, like all of it. That's all Andrea Romano.
Yeah.
And she is very warm and very sweet. And so, you know, her retirement party was this who's who of amazingly talented, you know, it's like you and Mark Hamill and Fillion and Weird Al and Paul Rubens.
John DiMaggio
and Paulson and Maurice LaMarche and Tom Kenny. And of course, everyone got up and spoke. And but then it occurred to me afterwards, like it was almost like a eulogy. Where I was like, you can still hang out with this lady.
I know.
She's still going to.
She's out of the industry, Chris. She's gone.
I'm like a kid. It's like, well, you can still come back, can't you? I wish she would. But what was also fun about Andrea's shows is Warner Brothers does it as a play. All, you know, they don't record you separately. You're all there recording, so you do the show like a play. And that is the most fun. It's the most fun way to do it. And she's such a good director. And she taught me so much. And then the first series I did was Hysteria.
Oh, yeah.
And the cast was Maurice LaMarche, Rob Paulson, Jess Harnell, Tress MacNeille, Billy West, Jeff Bennett.
Jesus.
And Frank Welker.
Oh, my God.
And me. It's like, what am I doing here? It was amazing. It was
You're a great founding member of SNL.
Well, that doesn't always translate, believe me. Believe me. But, I found my niche.
I mean, Paulson's one of those guys that he can, and Jeff Bennett's this way, and Dee Bradley Baker is also way, where you can't always track them because their ranges are so insane. Yeah. That Paulson can sing super high falsetto and then go low, and you can't. It's like these guys. There's just something going on,
and
they're
click through it.
Yeah. There's something that's going on in these throats. It's like you hear these old stories about Mel Blanc about how, you know, he could do Daffy Duck imitating bugs. Like he could do characters imitating other characters. So it wasn't him doing Daffy. It was like And so, but these guys have that same sort of skill sets. And DiMaggio is just like a fucking bulldozer.
Yeah.
That you know, him and Kevin Michael Richardson in a room are unfucking stoppable.
Oh, I know. Well, I think Bradley Baker especially, and Frank Welker in terms of sound effects. I was talking to Steve Martin about Frank Welker because they did stand up at the same time. And he said that Frank did the sound effects of a duck with her ducklings walking through a stream, you know, and all of it, the water, the mother duck, the ducklings, you know, he had never seen anything like it.
Wow.
But stand-up was never a thing that appealed to you in any way?
No, I never wanted to be by myself on stage, you know, although at the Groundlings, that's exactly what I was for the most part. I did character monologues. Well, they changed the sets. No, stand-up is a whole different animal. And it's so funny to me because people think that's my background. And it's not in any way. And both my kids are doing stand-up.
Are they enjoying it?
Yeah.
Good.
Nice.
Yeah. They have an aptitude.
Well, the L.A. stand-up landscape,
it's so exciting.
It's a good time. There's a lot of really good. And, of course, sadly, Meltdown's about to close.
Yeah. What?
Meltdown's closing.
Why?
Gaston's just kind of – he did it for 25 years. He's moving on. He's got a bunch of other stuff that he's doing.
No. Yeah.
It's one of those things where it's sad for the community, good for Gaston. Like, yeah. Nice. He's ending it on his terms.
Well, also, I mean, it's not the best time in the world to own a giant comic book shop on a major street like Sunset Boulevard.
Yeah, the parking sucks.
Where the parking sucks, but also just – you know, it's just like any bookstore would have the same, you know, people are buying stuff on apps or they're just ordering it through Amazon and not necessarily.
I never thought of that.
And so it's, you know, but that community was such a great community because the Nerdist Theater was in the back, and then there were classes, and people would read comics, and they'd play D&D. So, you know, I hope there's another clubhousey thing that, kind of launches.
But I heard the Lyric Theater on Hyperion, that's becoming, people are starting to say that's starting to have the feel of the Meltdown.
Oh, good.
Like, is that where they do Hot Tub?
No, that's a Virgil. The Hyperion is just like, it's on Hyperion and Silver Lake, and it's a theater, but everyone's starting to do like weird gonzo shows and plays, and it's all comics doing experimental stuff, and people are saying like it feels like
oh, peak, that's great,
like Meltdown kind of stuff.
Yeah, the West Side Comedy Theater is like that too, and it's on my side of town.
Hey,
yeah,
I'd go to that place more if it was closer.
I know. Yeah. The West Side for comedy can be a little tough.
I know. But for me, going to the East Side, as much as I want to, it's like, oh, look at this lineup. Oh, God damn it. Oh, I got to stay on the couch. I'm tired.
That's a lot of traffic getting in there. I got to park.
Yes,
and, yes. I don't know if I feel like. But it seems like that, you know, whatever you were going through at that time and whatever sort of drugs you did and whatever sort of, you know, it seems like you got your shit together because, you know, I feel like we've had conversations before where you've sort of made jokes about like, you know, my over-therapied opinion on this is or something. I mean, like, how did you kind of emerge from all that stuff and how did you start to get healthier?
Well, I wanted to live. I really wanted to live. I thought that I wanted to die, but it wasn't happening fast enough. I think that there's an element of any drug addict, they just don't care about the consequences. They're, in the back of their mind, they know that they could die, but they don't care because they want to get out of that feeling so badly. I think close to my bottom, I found myself a passenger in the front seat of a car being driven by Hunter Thompson.
Oh my God.
He's like balancing a tumbler of whiskey, threading his cigarette into the cigarette holder, and incidentally driving. You know, and even as fucked up as I was at that time, I thought, this is risky. I shouldn't be here right now. Why? And so, you know, I got to a point where I couldn't audition at all. I was in such bad shape. It wasn't that I would go to an audition high, but the mindset, I was so depressed that it infected my bearing in those situations. And I was 85 pounds. I mean, it was gruesome. And my agent called me after one that I knew was abysmal. He said, how do you think it went? And I said, it was terrible. He said, well, I'm glad that you're aware of that because they called me and they wanted to know what was wrong with you.
Oh.
You know, and they said they wondered if you had AIDS, and I was like, I don't have AIDS. I'm a coke addict, goddamn it! How dare you? You know.
The indignation.
I know.
I'm a coke addict.
I don't have a disease. Well, I guess I do.
This is no accident.
Yeah. So I checked myself into a Brotman Memorial Hospital Chemical Dependency Unit. April 28th, 1987, not knowing that I would get AA or anything like that. Just thought that I'd be able to learn how to do drugs healthy.
Yeah, sure.
In
yeah.
a good way, you yeah. know, Percocet and things like that. And whatever it was that I heard, I was ready to hear. And I think one of the things was, you don't have to live like this. And it just changed my life. And I've never looked back. I had so long being an addict that, you know, I forgot that I was. I mean, I've had painkillers in the house and forgotten about them. And then, like, one day I was like, oh, God, this is a shit day. I'm going to go take this Percocet. Hey, aren't I an addict? aren't I an AA? All right. Yeah. Okay.
The muscle memory of just reaching for the thing.
God.
I mean, I think it's good for people to hear stories like that because, first of all, when you're in it, most people, myself included, you always feel like, no, it's fine. I got this. This is just part of my thing. You know, like I'm just, it's recreational. It's part of my thing. But then when you get to the other side, then you have the, right. Oh, and that's why. Oh, that's why I lost this and this, and that's why that. It's all these things that you think are so. Like, if you saw someone else do it, you go, "Well, it's very obvious that you're creating a lot of this. You're running away, and you need to, you know. But when you're in it, it's very hard to see.
Well,
so.
I have to say, I always knew that once I started, I couldn't stop. I knew that I had a deadly problem, and that I never kidded myself about it. And it was, I mean, I was a depressed kid, and so it was just like the natural progression. It was sugar, and then it was that, and, you know, so on. Now it's watching TV. but it's... I never had any doubt that it was a problem. I always knew that. So that when I became sober, you know, I knew what to look for. I knew what to look for in my thinking that would justify any kind of bullshit. And I knew how to avoid it because I was taught how.
Right.
You know?
Because it doesn't, you know, when you first get sober, it doesn't fix all of your problems.
Of course not.
It just gives you the clarity to do the work to figure out why,
exactly,
or how to, you know, how to begin the process of fixing, moving on, patching holes, growing, getting stronger. So
perfectly said.
Yeah, so I just, you know, I always
caution. Is this my intervention, Chris?
Mm-hmm, yeah, Jonah.
Jonah, we love you. And
I don't.
An eye on the driveway.
I'm fine with you, to be honest.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
But it just, so I caution people if they say, like, hey, I'm thinking about getting sober, and I will say to them, like, look, you don't expect that the second it happens, because that can make people relapse and go, well, I quit and fucking nothing got better.
Yeah.
You know, this is where you have to just, you know, don't think about it all at once. Just focus on the one day at a time thing, but just know that it's a process.
Yeah.
And that, you know, it will, before you know it, you know, one day you'll be like, hey, I kind of feel okay. That's new.
Well, the first year when I took my first year chip or cake or whatever, I was furious. Because I had my feelings now, you know, something that I fought vigilantly to not have. So, you know, it took me a long time, but the inventories are so great because they really force you to look at your thinking and your behavior. But boy, I just knew that that wasn't an option anymore. I couldn't go back to it. I knew that also, you know, people can slip and come back. I knew I did not have a second recovery in me.
Mm.
I knew it. So there was no way I was going to take that chance.
Yeah, that's an important step too, is also recognizing, respecting the power of your addiction.
Yeah.
Just knowing, you know, I mean, I know now still, and I've said to Lydia before, I don't ever miss it, but I know, like, oh, if I had one drink, I said it would probably just be a couple weeks before I would be, because I know I wouldn't want to stop. I would just want to keep doing it. And always remembering that is really helpful, because I go, well, that's a choice, but I don't want that. I want this other choice.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's what I choose to do.
It's a wonderful place to be. It's a wonderful kind of knowledge to have. And it's also a great way to live. Being responsible, being honest. If you do something to someone, you immediately own it and apologize. That's a great way to live.
Yeah. Was there a period of time where you felt like, well, now I'm going to go back and try to undo some of the damage of career stuff and let everyone know that I'm okay and look at what my work options are? Were you just like, I'm not even going to bother with that. I'm just going to focus on being healthy and not even think about work stuff.
Yeah, that was the first thing. And then, you know, I got back into taking classes at the Groundlings, the lab classes and creating new characters. My sister was a teacher and director there. And I just thought, you know, I've got to learn how to do things that a lot of people already know how to do. And that was hard on me too, because, you know, you wake up and you're 35 and it's like, I'm a middle-lessened. You know, this is embarrassing, you know. But I had the humility to understand that this is just going to be my story and my path. And one thing I have always been is passionate and curious about the things that I love, like music and comedy. Still, always really love it and am inspired by it, as I say. So the things that interest me in life are what inspire me and make me joyous, you know.
And even being able to accept that feeling of joy is like a big deal. Like, it's a very big deal, because, you know, most people who have what we have don't want it. Uh-huh. Or they smush it down, or they feel like they don't deserve it in some way.
Wow. I'd like to meet him. No, I know of people that are like that too. It's heartbreaking.
Yeah, but, you know, I think when people hear that and they hear you say that, and whenever this comes up on the podcast, some people are like, oh, get it, you're sober. But it's always for like a handful of people will go, I just heard that at the right time.
Yeah.
And it just got me curious, and it just got me on this path. And
for you, that's like when your therapist just kind of mentioned it to you about getting sober. You said it was just that right moment.
You mean former SNL cast member Pamela Stevenson?
What?
Did you know her?
I didn't know her, but she became a therapist?
Yeah, she was my therapist. Great. She was the therapist that...
And Billy...
Connolly's wife. Yeah, was married to Billy Connolly. Goodness. And yeah. So, yeah, and a mutual friend of ours connected us because, you know, the girl I was dating at the time said, oh, you should probably just talk to a therapist and figure out why you're drinking, you know. I'm not saying quit, just figure it out. And so a friend of mine was like, oh, you know, my friend Pamela Stevenson. I'm like, oh, my God, what a great therapist. She is a comedian who is married to a comedian.
Great.
Yeah, and Pamela was the one that that just said one day after like a year, she was like, you look like shit. Go to rehab right now. And I
That's
was like,
great.
Okay. And yeah. I didn't even question. I was like, oh, I guess I could, you know. Kind of like what you said. Oh, I guess I could just do that.
Yeah.
Sure.
Well, I was in a therapy with a woman that was a very big German-looking woman who was from Argentina. Need I say more? And the first thing she said to me is, I can't treat you until you get sober. And that was when, you know, I checked myself in.
Oh,
and it was humiliating, too, because I felt like, what more of a cliche could I be than a late-night TV actor who's in comedy, who's a drug addict. It was so humiliating, you know?
But you have to forgive yourself for that stuff. I was like, well, it is what it is. But it is one of those slippery slopes where, like you said, oh, I woke up one day and I was 35. And, you know, you can just go, where did 5 years go? Or where did 10 years go? Or how am I here? But it's never too late to just scrap all that and just start today.
Yeah.
Start from today. So... What lessons do you feel like you're still learning, or what things do you still feel like, you know, are valuable to you?
The big one that I'm working with now that has really made a difference for me is that people do not see me the way I see myself. I'm a twin, and so I'm used to being able to read someone else, but I can't read other people. I think I can, but I cannot. So, and I always assume the worst in people's behavior. Like, I know how I am when I want to keep people at arm's length. And if I see that behavior in someone else, well, that's what they're doing, you know? But I can't assume that. It's an arrogance that I need to let go of because it's poison. It's so undermining because in your whole life you're trying to prove yourself. You know, you're trying to get someone to like you when, first of all, you can't control that, but you got to come off like you like yourself. I know this is pretty basic shit, but, you know, I'm just kind of learning
it. It's great, though. I mean, it's just...
No, for sure.
It resonates so well, and, you know, listen, I'm not religious in any way, but... It's interesting to me that sometimes things are happening in my life and then someone will come on the podcast and I'll go, God damn it, I was just, that's crazy. But I just had an experience where the last podcast where I ran into some people that I met for the first time and one of them said, oh, I really, I enjoyed when you were subbing in on the Kelly Ripa show. And, you know, I don't know if you ever really wanted to do that job long term. And then I just proceeded to tell the story about what happened. Like, oh, and here was the behind the scenes. And they were like, okay, well, we got to go. And I walked away going, why did I just tell them that? They didn't need to know all that. I called Lydia and I was like, I'm such an arrogant piece of shit.
Yeah.
I don't know how to contact these people and tell them that I'm sorry that I made a group of like 12 people listen to my dumb fucking story about
shit
me.
Shit on your compliment.
Yes. Oh, what was wrong with just saying thanks?
Yeah, exactly.
Have a great day. Yeah. Have a great day. And so I beat myself up so, so horribly. And so just to hear you say like, when you joked earlier and you go, well, you know other people see you the way you see yourself. I mean, I don't know what the takeaway from that was, and I still hate myself for it, but God damn it, it's just so nice to hear you say, like, you know, just, you don't know everything.
Yeah, and it's also that there's the Jack story where the guy's car breaks down in the desert, and he's walking to the gas station, which is like a mile away, and he's thinking, that guy's going to gouge me. He's going to cheat me because he knows I'm over a barrel, and then when he gets there, he's like, you son of a bitch! And it's... You know, it's that kind of thing where it's like you projected a certain thing and that's your reality and that's it.
Right.
And that is a fucked way to live.
It is. But I also know that and this bent my mind one time. I think my therapist said this to me or I read it somewhere. But let's just say she said it. She said, not Pamela, but the one I'm talking to now. She said, whatever you think about yourself, you're right. And I was like, holy shit,
wow.
Because you manifest, you create that reality. So if you tell yourself you're a piece of shit, you are because you believe it.
Yeah.
And so you manifest that and you make choices along those lines. And she doesn't mean it in a universal sense, but it's just that that's what you make true for yourself.
Right.
So in other words, you really do have to have better self-talk and better, you know, don't always.
Well, it's hard to just assume that, it's hard to believe that something that you've trusted for so long might not be right, because it's like also your ability to discern what's funny has worked.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So why would you think that the things that you perceive that are negative are not right?
Right.
That is a hard one to let go.
Right.
You know?
Especially if you want to believe that stuff.
Yeah. Which is, you know, I don't know.
Do you have any, like, is it meditative, or is it? Do you just go, eh, I'm not going to bother with thinking that right now?
Yeah, I don't meditate, Chris.
Okay.
I know I'm a native of Los Angeles, but no. I'm too fidgety for that stuff, even though I know it's good.
It's great.
Jonah's been doing it.
Sorry, I remember talking about that. That's
yeah.
So great.
It's real nice. It's I'm a bit more precise with my actions on a day-to-day basis.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, and if I don't, I feel it real bad. Like I was talking to Emily like yesterday. I was like, it's like I feel like if I don't do it, my brain by the end of the day feels like it's going to vibrate out of my skull.
Wow.
If I do it,
Oscar nominee Emily B. Gordon.
Oscar nominated.
Yes.
I am.
Yes.
Yeah, it's like, so it's, that stuff, it's real nice. And I did the same thing where I'm like, my brain's popping all over the place. I can't meditate. I can't clear my mind. Mm-hmm. But when you find, there's all these different types of meditation. When you find the one that says to you, oh, it's okay if you can't clear your mind, mm-hmm. you know, just like just when the thought comes, or the way Jerry Seinfeld talks about TM, he says, it's like, it's your, when you're meditating, it's like you're in a boxing match with your thoughts and you're just bobbing and weaving and you're just letting the thoughts pass by you.
That.
And you're not like, you're not getting in front of the thought and then holding on to it.
Yeah.
You're dodging them. And then
that's beautiful.
And so when troubles come at you throughout the day, it's like, you know, like I used to be the kind of person where one little thing or one bad tweet, one text where I maybe messed up, you know, socially or something like that, I would just hold on to it. And now I kind of just go, well, you know, it's like if it is something that's serious, I will come back to it. But mm-hmm. if it doesn't really matter.
But the idea of clearing your mind is really can largely be at the basis of addiction. Mm-hmm. You're just trying to clear your mind.
Yeah.
It's just too many thoughts. Don't want to feel all these things. Mm-hmm. Don't want to feel all these feelings or think all these things. Think all these thoughts.
Yeah, I think it's like feel them, think them, but don't like, you know, don't let them control you.
Right.
You know, and that's what I like about the meditation. And it's been fantastic.
Can they make that on a pill? Kidding. Kidding.
I'm going to talk to my friends up in Big Pharma, see if we can get a TM pill.
No, you need someone to blow it in your asshole. It gets in your bloodstream a lot faster.
Yeah. That's a little personal.
Can you blow some meditation into my asshole?
But if you read David Lynch's book, Catching the Big Fish, it's this book where he just kind of has these little blurbs.
Who's the author?
David Lynch.
Oh, David Lynch.
Yeah. He's real big into the TM movement. And he has a book called Catching the Big Fish. And it's his thoughts on creativity. He also has, like, you know, there's all these, some chapters are just four sentences long. It's just this like quick little book to read. And it's, you know, some of the chapters are just about how he likes going to like Bob's Big Boy style diners and getting a chocolate shake. And like he says that there's something so neat about sitting and just drinking something you like and then like watching people.
That's just being present.
Yeah,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, TM is it does help you be present. But like I had the book for years. My friend Donald gave it to, he bought it for me because it was like David Lynch stuff. And
uh-huh.
I was like, that's cool. And he was at the bookstore, and he looked across the other side of the bookstore, and Matt Groening was there. And so he's like, hey, it's my friend's birthday. I got him this book. Could you sign it? So Matt Groening, in my David Lynch book, has drew a picture of Bart saying, yo, Jonah, happy birthday. I had nothing to do with this book, but I love David Lynch.
So if I read that book, will I understand Fire Walk With Me?
Yes.
No, you still won't.
Oh, okay. No. You still, that's a story that's happening in his head.
What?
In the book, does
dream
it...
logic. Transcendental.
But, you know, this... Yeah, that very thing, I think, is so vital of being... The being present thing, I think, is what we try to avoid when we're trying to distract ourselves with whatever it is. Work or drugs or alcohol or sex or anything. That it's just we're afraid to be present because... If we feel how we feel in a moment, that might be not pleasant.
But I think ultimately when we actually know how to really genuinely be present, it's a wonderful thing. It's a wonderful feeling. Thing and feeling.
It's a feeling.
It's a feeling.
Dancing on the feeling.
Is that the line on Richie Thong?
Yes.
That's my favorite. Also, Mom always said don't play ball in the house. Are you doing any live performance now?
I do Sketch Fest every year.
Yep.
Right now, what am I thinking? I don't know if I can talk about this because it was just a pilot that I recorded for a podcast because, you know, the world needs more of those.
Hey, listen, it's totally fine. You know, the more podcasts, the better. People get their specific podcast needs met. It is a golden age.
Well, this is the thing. I was, you know, filling out forms in offices, and whenever they say, what's your hobby? I think, you fuck. What? No, I don't have a hobby. I love to eat in front of the TV. That's what I love to do. And I thought, I'm going to make that a show. So with Emily Fleming.
Yep. Oh, my God, that's great.
Yeah.
She was a writer on At Midnight.
Yeah, really I know. She's a very good stand-up and writer. I came up with the show, Eat in Front of the TV. So we, you know, talk about what you wear when you eat in front of the TV and what happened to that piece of clothing that it's come so low. What do you eat? And then what do you watch? And the pilot, we had Henry Zebrowski on.
Nice.
And he chose Project Runway, which was it was so great. It was really good. So we've edited it, we've submitted it, and we'll see what happens.
God, Emily is so funny. I met her in New York. She was working at the Jack Spade store. She was working in retail clothing. And, you know, comics just recognize other comics. And the second she started talking, I was like, what do you do? And she was like, well, you know, I'm a comedian. I'm like, I knew it! And then we became friends, and she moved out to L.A. And I said, you should come on At Midnight. And she came on and destroyed the first time she was on.
Yeah.
So we kept having her back, and a slot opened up, and we offered her a writing position. And she – that was a deceivingly hard show to get right away in terms of how to build it. And she just, like, right out of the gate, you know, her suggestions and jokes were so great.
That's
awesome. And she's just funny as shit. I'm so glad you guys became friends
she's
and are doing
really...
the thing together. Well, is there anything else you want to plug or promote? Do you have any animated things?
Let's see. There are two that have not been announced, so I can't talk about them. One is a sequel to a Guillermo del Toro show that I did, Troll Hunter. In fact, when I recorded it, I had just heard your interview with him.
Oh, great.
And so I wore my Famous Monsters t-shirt with all these masks on it, just in case. But I thought, well, he's so busy, he's not going to be there. Well, he was there.
Oh, right.
And so we're figuring out these sounds for these characters. He says, well, I wanted to sound like Miss Hathaway from the Beverly Hillbillies. It's like, God, how do you know that shit? Like, you know, he's so brilliant.
Yeah.
But and so there's another one. Oh, I got to just tell you this one thing that I found
Please.
Out. The sets for Shape of Water were repurposed sets from The Strain.
Oh no!
Oh
way.
Wow!
Isn't that amazing?
Oh, cause that's
I just
right,
found that
like,
out.
He like called in a ton of favors for Shape of Water, right? So
yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah,
worked out.
Yeah,
painted it.
Sure did.
Did it.
Yeah. I read a theory about, as I call it, the shape of masturbating in water. But it's but there's a theory that the main character was a fish person.
Yes.
Oh, okay, you're already.
Well, I figured that was the whole thing with the scars on
her
neck.
Yeah, she was. Yeah, that's.
Yeah.
Great. Well, I just
heard there was.
I just want to make sure you guys remember.
The thing you already knew.
Yeah.
Emily Heller.
She had gills. That's why she could breathe underwater.
Exactly. Emily Heller had a great joke about that. She's like, I called bullshit on Shape of Water when she masturbated in the tub and didn't use the faucet for it.
I love her.
I can picture her saying it too.
So good.
That makes it even funnier. That's so funny. You know, I always tease Lydia. She'll say things like that that are somewhat. She goes, I know I'm Captain Obvious. And I go, no, you're Admiral Obvious. You have. You're way higher in the ranks than Captain. And I did something the other night, and she was like, oh, are you Admiral now? Like, it was just really fun.
Nice. Chop.
So I got to have my Admiral. You know what I think, you guys? I think she was a fish person the whole time.
You know the thing that
you
the
mean
movie set up cinematically.
Stating the obvious that everybody else already knows?
Yeah. Listen, the point is, I just wanted something else to beat myself up over to supplant the other thing that I was beating myself
up
over.
You're going to get this out of the podcast, aren't you?
No, I'm leaving it in. I'm leaving it in because I deserve to have it be left in.
No.
Yes, you're a public service. Come on.
Yeah, you're right, Lorraine.
Learn from my stupid idiot mistakes.
God damn it. Fuck. And then you guys just slowly back out. Yes. He's having a thing by himself, I think. But, you know, I've always been so delighted and pleased by what a kind and supportive, not just comedy fan you are, but human being that you are.
Oh, thanks.
And I've appreciated that you were a fan of At Midnight, and you came to see before my last special, you came to the practice show at Meltdown, and
she was so nice that she appeared in a sketch in Hidden America. That's how nice she is.
But just know that you are adored and appreciated.
Thank you so much, you guys.
And
thanks.
And I'm so happy that you came.
I'm so delighted to do it. I love your show so much. And your shows.
Oh,
very
thank,
much.
Thank you for staying over here.
Sometimes there's a third guy on the podcast, but he's MIA.
Yes, I love Matt.
Ever since he.
We love him too.
Yeah.
You know, whenever he gets a girlfriend, that's it. Yeah. We don't see him.
Yeah, it kind of was. But now Matt's like. He was working so much that I think he just fell off the map after.
Yeah, I've done that before too, where it's like I was like, oh, I'm gonna, like, I'll tell you, like, I'm finishing work this week, and then I'm free to do podcasts, and then I finish work, I'm like, I don't want to do anything. Yeah.
It's just the marathon. It's like, okay, I know the finish line is over there. If I can just crawl to it, and then once I'm past it, then don't touch me.
Yeah.
I'm just going to fall. So he's just, he's recharging right
now. He wants to eat in front of the TV.
He wants to eat in front of the TV. Any good shows that you're watching that you want to throw out
you
there?
Nordic noir and horror on Netflix is the best.
Yeah,
and
they got
also
some good stuff on Shudder too.
Yeah, thank you for referring me to Shudder.
Oh, great.
That's been a great resource for my horror.
Oh, great. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we had this conversation the last time we were pitching each other horror movies.
Yeah.
And the streaming channel thing they do is so great too.
Yeah.
You can just turn on like the Slashix channel.
I know.
Yeah, I love it.
The psychological thriller channel.
Yeah, Evil Grin.
Oh, there was a really fun one. I think it was called Veronica, maybe. I think it's a Spanish. It's Spanish horror, but it's like a demon possession kind of a
Dee was talking about that. She wants to watch that.
Yeah, it was
Cold Hell is their new one that's supposed to be really good.
Yeah, I haven't seen it yet, but I want to. Yeah.
Oh, and I was going to actually see if the Beatnik sketch was on the SNL app.
Oh, I hope it is.
So let me just see really fast if... No, this one didn't come up. But it's still, like, you know, again, do you ever visit SNL ever, or is it just like...
I think I was there for, well, obviously the 40th. And before that, it was just, I happened to be in New York for something and I don't remember what it was, but I don't go to New York that often. If I do, it's, you know, it's sometimes it's just a hassle to get tickets. And I always want to see the dress rehearsal because to me, those are better to see because you see sketches that are cut eventually and will never be seen again, which is so unfortunate.
Oh, I can't even imagine the treasure trove of...
Oh, well, that's why I love Seth, who has his talk show. Seth.
Myers.
He has, what is it, Rerun Theater?
Oh, right.
Unappreciated Theater or something like that.
Yeah.
And he does the sketches that didn't make it.
That's what I liked about Tim Robinson's episode of Characters on Netflix.
I haven't seen that yet.
It's my favorite one of that like, you know, that one season they did where everyone did their sketches. But they're clearly all the sketches he wrote that didn't make it in while he was writing at SNL. And so they're just like all amazing. Tim Robinson. He's one of the co-stars of Detroiters, which is with Sam Richardson, one of the funniest shows on television right now.
I got to check that out. Comedy Central?
Yeah, Comedy Central.
Yeah, you know, sometimes I'll go back and watch Comedy Central.
Oh, God.
Remember when we were dominating the late night blocks, Chris?
Remember when we were on top, man? We were on top of the late night.
And now we sit at home and watch Kumail and Emily.
I was big once. Yeah.
Remember when we were sandwiched in the lower middle of late nights?
Living large.
Yeah, living medium. So you're going right for the middle
Sweet
of the bag.
0.003 Woo! Share.
We were not flying.
It's hard for me to understand. Really. It was so good.
I'm sorry. We were sitting over here talking about ourselves and you're the guest.
That's all right. No.
I got to get going.
What?
I got to go to another podcast. I'm doing the Trailers from Hell podcast with Joe Dante.
I've never heard of that one.
Fantastic and fancy.
Well, yeah. Jonah.
Get out.
He apparently is.
Meet Joe Dante.
I'm very excited, but also I'm scared, because the reason I'm on is he's not a very big fan of Mystery Science Theater and never really has been. He finds it insulting to cinema.
So is this an exploratory?
Yes, I'm here to be like, well, I think there's room for all of it.
Well, Mr.
It's okay to, you know, make fun of stuff sometimes.
Yeah. Growing up, I loved Gremlins and Mystery Science Theater, and I never felt that you should separate them.
Oh, my God. You have to let me know how that
goes. Darn it.
I will.
All right.
Have fun.
Bye, Jonah.
Bye. Thank you. Bye.
Lorraine.
Good to see you. Thank you so much. Mwah.
And I'll talk to you soon, because I've got to have her on Jonah Radio. She's a big EDM head.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Yes.
You got to come to our festival. The IDT Festival.
Has EDM?
Yes, yes. There's a big EDM, and we're moving it to Orange County this year.
Oh, my God.
You'll be on the guest list. I'll give you some passes.
Oh, my God.
But now I feel like Katie should end the podcast because you love her voice so much. Here, you say the thing.
Enjoy your burrito.
There it is. So you said it like a question. You know.
So cute.
I don't know why I said it like that.
You phone dropping. No, I'm kidding. All right, the end.
Thank you.
ID10T scanning complete. Enjoy your burrito.
I feel like I was blindsided.
Because it's a competition show.
From the producers of Jury Duty and The Bachelor.
We have scoured the earth for the 14 greatest reality contestants that were available during our production window.
Comes a reality competition show about reality competition shows.
Nobody has dared to find out who is the actual best at just being on a reality show. I'm your host, comedian Daniel Tosh.
It's win or go home.
Each episode, our contestants will face new challenges that will test their strength and lack of life skills for a chance to win $200
million.
$200,000.
Prepare, because it's about to be ugly, crying, lots of fighting.
Tayshia, I have to defend myself.
Celebrating 25 years of reality TV with your favorites.
I have diarrhea. You cannot do this to me.
What in gay hell have I got myself into?
The GOAT. Stream free on Amazon Freevee or Prime Video.